Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument, United States versus Gerke. Mr. Broderick.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Greg Broderick for Appellant Gerke Excavating. In this case, Gerke is charged with what could be viewed as a per se violation of the Clean Water Act. And there's no evidence in the record that shows that the clean fill that was placed on this property, this normally dry property, ever causes any actual pollution in any truly navigable waters. And therefore, to sustain this charge against Gerke, it's necessary for the government to extend the definition of the term navigable waters under the Clean Water Act to land some 64 miles away from the nearest navigable water. Now, in this appeal, we argue that the particular regulatory provision the government relies on to claim that this normally dry property is, in fact, a navigable water goes far beyond what Congress could have intended. In the few minutes that I have, I'd like to focus on three main points. I know we raised a number in the briefs, but I'd like to focus on the fact that Congress never intended the Clean Water Act to go this far. The application of these regulations as a property at issue in this case is not informed by the term navigable and therefore goes beyond what the Supreme Court has permitted in Swank and Riverside Bayview. And finally, applying the Clean Water Act to this property raises serious constitutional questions in the absence of a clear statement from Congress supporting such an inquiry.
It was 64 miles away. If it was 5 miles away?
Well, for our purposes, 5 miles or 64 miles, actually for the district court's purposes, it doesn't matter either. The district court, 5 miles
in
or 64.
In your view, it doesn't matter if it's 2 feet away.
Well, if it were 2 feet away and inseparably bound up with and immediately adjacent to, it would matter. If it were two
adjacent
feet away.
I don't understand the use of this word adjacent when you're talking about bodies of water. Adjacent means side by side. You can't have two bodies of water that adjoin side by side. Right?
Well, in Riverside.
They mingle or one flows into another, right?
In Riverside Bayview, they did have two waters that were side by side.
What is that? I don't understand side by side. They just said they're not mingling?
They do have a connection, but it's not as though they're necessarily one water. But they have.
What does that mean?
It's not necessarily
one water. What kind of metaphysical statement is that?
In Riverside Bayview.
With the case. Do they mingle or don't they mingle?
They would have to mingle.
Right. So they're not adjacent.
Well,
adjacent means side by side. They're not side by side. They're intermingled.
Well, in Riverside, they don't have to be intermingled such that the...
They're intermingled, right? The two bodies of water flowing into each other, mingled, so on, right?
Yeah, yes.
So this wetland water is, you know, mingling with the navigable waters. It's all one body of water.
Well, that's not quite how the Supreme Court has used the term.
Well, physically, it's one body of water.
That's not how the Supreme Court has...
Physically, it is one body of water, whatever the legal situation is.
I don't think so. A water can share a connection with another water and not be one body of water, as in...
That's a metaphysical statement. What do you mean, not but one body of water?
Well, the Supreme Court considered the creek in Riverside Bayview and the wetlands to be two different waters. Well, and in that case, the waters did share, the wetland and the navigable water shared a kind of connection, and the court was willing to go ahead and defer to the Corps' understanding that the wetlands are regulated.
Talk that way about water shared a kind of connection.
Well, in Riverside Bayview, there are different kinds of connections a water could share. And in Riverside Bayview, the court found that the wetlands don't have to be inundated by the navigable water, but as long as the wetlands can flow into the navigable waters eventually, or not eventually, but...
Inundated? How could the wetlands be inundated by the navigable water?
They don't
Does
have
the water
to...
flow from the wetlands to the navigable stream?
In some cases, although in Riverside Bayview, they also discussed the possibility that, in fact, the arguments that the appellants...
Well, what's the situation here? Does the water here flow from the wetlands into the, you know, into the culvert and...
Yeah, that was the finding.
Mississippi eventually.
That was the finding of the court below, that the wetland shared a hydrological connection with a ditch, and then the ditch flowed to a creek and
the
culvert.
Words like that. The water from the wetlands flows into the stream that eventually goes into the Mississippi, right?
Yes, that's correct. But they're not They are indeed distinct bodies of water, even though they're the...
I didn't know a distinct body.
Pardon me?
What's the total volume of wetlands water that's flowing into navigable waterways?
Well, that actually reaches a navigable waterway. In this case, we have no idea because...
No, aggregate.
In the whole
How
world?
Important are wetlands in the supply of water to navigable waterways in the United States?
I don't know.
Well, that's important, isn't it?
Well, yes, and the court...
Yes, well, if it's important and you don't know it and you have the burden of proof, then you're in trouble.
Well, with the court...
Why don't you investigate these things? If you really think that there's no significant effect of wetlands water on navigable waterways, why don't you find out what the volume of water is that's flowing from these wetlands into the navigable waterway system?
Because it's our argument that it doesn't matter what the volume is.
Well, that's
the line,
very strange, because if the volume is huge, then, you know, pollution or it's being dried out or what have you could actually have an effect on navigable waterways.
Well, that's possible, but it's our argument that Congress drew the line here not at every water that might affect the navigable waterway, but at a much closer point in order to balance its goals to clean up the waters, but also its goals
to
respect...
But the balance depends on the volume, doesn't it?
Right, and my point is that's a choice for Congress to make and not for the Justice Department.
But they made a judgment about the volume of water emitted by wetlands?
I think they made a judgment that in order to...
Did they talk about that? Is that in the legislative history?
I don't think they made that in the legislative history, but in the statute itself, they adopted... 1251A, which says we want to clean up the navigable waters, but they also adopted 1251B, which says we want to respect the state's primary role as the regulators of land and water use. And so that's where Congress struck the balance.
Well, where do you see that in the...
33 U.S.C. 1251B.
Where's that in your brief?
In my brief, I'm not sure what page it's on in our brief, but I can almost quote it for you from memory.
No, I don't want your almost quote.
Okay. It will be in the section of our brief that discusses here. It's in our reply brief at pages 4 and 24. It's cited, and section 1251A is cited at page 20 of our reply brief.
Well, you're putting everything on the statutory language. So where's the statutory language?
Of section 1251A or of the Clean Water Act?
You said that Congress had struck this balance, so presumably you're relying on some specific statutory language.
Yeah, yes, on the
Where
definition.
Where is that?
We're relying on section...
What does it say?
1311A says...
Where are you reading from?
From memory. 33 U.S.C. section 1311A.
The whole argument pivots on the statutory language, so don't you want to point us to that precise language?
Yes, and the language is very simple. It's a one...
Well, why don't you show us where it is so we can look at it rather than rely on your memory?
I believe it's at the very beginning of our brief, but I do not recall what page it's on in our opening brief. I didn't bring the brief up here with me. 33 U.S.C. section 1311A does say, however, that... It's unlawful to discharge any material from a point source into a navigable water. And navigable waters is defined in section 1352, subsection 7, as waters of the United States. But what the Supreme Court has said is that Congress only exerted its traditional power over navigable waters, and that's on page 160. Specifically in footnote 3, it says, neither this nor anything else in the legislative history signifies, and I'm quoting now, that Congress intended to exert anything more than than its commerce power over navigation. And that power has been historically limited to waters that are or could be used in interstate commerce. And that quote comes from page 172 of the court's opinion in Swank. And...
I don't think you actually quoted the statute we're relying on.
I'm not certain if we did as I stand up here now, although I can't imagine that we didn't. But Section 1311A is...
You said it was 1251?
1251A is the statutory section.
That's what you rely on.
That's the statutory...
But you don't actually quote it.
1251A and 1251B are the purpose section.
You don't quote them. Odd.
Well, those are simply the purpose sections. The main hook of our argument is on the Swank case and on the Riverside Bayview case, and we think that's what this case really comes down to, is which case this court thinks is controlling, Swank or Riverside Bayview. The Swank decision, after discussing its holding in Riverside, or after discussing Riverside Bayview, says that its holding in that case is that the Corps had jurisdictions over wetland, and I'm quoting here from page 167, wetlands that actually abutted on a navigable waterway. Now, in the court goes on to discuss that it was Congress there, they allowed a kind of a narrow exception, although they don't use the term exception, but a narrow exception.
Well, Bayview is about isolated ponds that aren't connected. And here there is a connection. So I don't know, I don't mean,
it's
I
true.
Mean Swank. It's so I don't know how Swank carries the day for you.
Well, it Swank's discussion of Riverside Bayview makes it clear that Riverside is a limited case that doesn't address these kinds of adjacency problems.
Well, assuming it's an open question, I don't understand the logic of your argument, because all this, these wetlands are connected to navigable waterways. What does it matter what the mode of connection is?
Well, the Swank Court, I suppose, indicates that it matters. It
no,
says
it doesn't, because it talks about isolated wetlands, isolated ponds. Obviously, if they're isolated, they're not connected.
True, but on page...
Suppose they flow from, you know, into navigable waterways. That's not Swank.
No, that's not the exact factual situation in Swank, but in
that's
Swank...
That's not the factual situation. I don't think exact is... The difference
right.
is critical.
But in Swank, what they say, and I think this is what points to the answer to this question here, is they say in Riverside Bayview, we left open this question of whether there was jurisdiction over wetlands adjacent to open waters. And then they answer that question on page 168. Right after they say we left it open in Riverside Bayview, they say the jurisdiction of the court does not extend, or I'm sorry, they say we would have to hold that the jurisdiction of the court, now I'm quoting from page 168, extends to ponds that are not adjacent to open waters, but we conclude that the text of the statute will not allow this. So whereas that question was left open in Riverside Bayview, it's not left open here.
No, that's not. That wasn't the case. It wasn't. The point was the ponds were isolated. Here they are connected to open water, the open water that flows into these navigable waterways.
Well, the narrow understanding of Swank that was adopted by the Deaton Court and the Rapanos Court took that view.
Why would you think the court, in a case dealing with isolated ponds, would be dealing with our case as well?
Because they said so themselves. They said right on page 167.
That's just your interpretation of the words open water. Where do they set forth a principle that might govern this case?
Well, they use the terms open water.
That's
and
term. Look, the principle. What is the principle?
The principle, I believe, is that Congress's jurisdiction under the Commerce Clause has always been limited to waters that are navigable or could easily be made navigable. And
always is a strong word. You must remember the line, the famous line, that if somebody brought a bucket of water into Justice Story's courtroom, he would declare the Admiralty jurisdiction over it.
Well, from
so the proposition that back at the beginning, everybody understood that it had to be something you could float a ship on, very hard to understand.
That's
the whole early history of the Supreme Court was in line with Justice Story's view.
That's not the jurisdiction
of the United States extended to waters of all kinds.
That's not the that's not our understanding of the case. From 1823 in the Gibbons decision, it was even a question whether Congress had any jurisdiction over navigable waters. Of course, Justice Marshall found that they did.
Do you want to reopen that question?
No, I do not. Yeah. We agree that they do have jurisdiction over navigable waters, but from
all got resolved Justice Story's way at the time.
From 1823 up until the adoption of these regulations in 1975, jurisdiction was limited to the navigable waters used for navigability. Riverside Bayview.
What if there were evidence that the drying up of a wetlands would render a river non-navigable?
Then I think you would be able to show a direct and immediate effect on a navigable water, and I think the court would have jurisdiction there. But I only have 1 minute left, and I'd like to save that for
rebuttal. Yeah, okay, you can.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Hazard, so
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Catherine Hazard here on behalf of the United States. First, I wanted to address this 33 U.S.C. 1251B argument, just to point out that I didn't see that as a statutory argument raised in their opening brief, so I would presume it's waived. I don't have the statutory language either. I did look at it because it was mentioned in the reply brief, and my understanding is that's a part of the purpose of the Act, which describes sort of the nature of the relationship between the EPA administrator and the states, including if states want to adopt their own clean water program. In this case, the district court held that the Army Corps of Engineers' interpretation of the Clean Water Act is extending to wetlands adjacent to tributaries of traditional navigable waters is reasonable and entitled to deference and is within Congress's authority to regulate commerce
among
the states.
Does the definition of wetlands have any size limitation? I mean, could you have wetlands that was 1 square foot?
No, it doesn't have a size limitation,
well,
as far as I know.
That would be a little weird, wouldn't it? I mean, a little muddy patch somewhere with a wetland.
That isn't the issue in this case, Your Honor, and I actually would need to consult the Corps' manual to see if they do have a size description. What I do know is that Gerke accepted that these are wetlands within the Corps' definition and that the ditch, drain, and creek, all three of which these wetlands flow into, are tributaries within the Corps' interpretation of that term. So what they're disputing
is... Yes, I mean, they could accept that it was a wetland, but what if it were, you know, 1 square inch?
It's not here. Obviously, if it was 1 square inch and the Corps asserted jurisdiction over it, which... I've never seen such a case, but if they did, and if the applicant for a permit was denied a permit, certainly that might be considered arbitrary and capricious.
Well, how much, well, of course, they argue that, you know, your position would extend federal control over, I don't know, half the country or something, but do we have any idea how extensive wetlands are?
There's one, I mean, I'm sure the Corps could answer that question. I don't have the answer as far as the acreage nationwide, but I believe in Byrd there's a sort of an example, which is that the Corps described the lake at issue in this in U.S. versus Byrd as approximately 12,000 acres. If you look on the internet to see what that lake looks like, it's described as more like 3,000 acres. So it's, I think that gives you some indication, at least for that lake, what the relationship is between the wetlands and the open body of water. I don't know if that's responsive, Your Honor.
You're talking about this?
No, in Byrd.
Oh. So how extensive are Gerke's wetlands?
The wetlands filled, I don't have the acreage for that either, Your Honor. I think it's 1.5 acres, something in that neighborhood.
Is there some place where the Corps of Engineers has a database of wetlands? I suppose if one just looked up wetland size in the United States, it would be so dominated by the Everglades that it wouldn't be interesting. Probably dominated by the Mississippi Delta, if it's not dominated.
And Alaska,
by the Everglades.
Also, Your Honor, I think.
Yes, a lot of Alaska is indeed
wetlands. More all the time, perhaps.
Are there places where this is broken down by region?
I can get that information for you. I don't have
that.
I don't know that offhand. I'm sorry.
Okay.
If someone from the Corps were here, they might be able to respond to that. In May, I know that there was a recent
Is there any
promulgation.
Limiting principle here? Or
Yes, there are limiting principles, which relate to, first of all, whether the property is, in fact, a wetland, which Gerke contested in the district court but doesn't contest here. And then whether they are adjacent to, bordering, contiguous, neighboring, a tributary of a traditional navigable water. And this clearly is. It flows in three directions into waters that flow into the Wisconsin River.
Would it matter if the flow went the other way?
Yeah, it probably would.
Why?
If it went solely the other direction, I think it would be difficult to say that the wetlands... I mean, maybe there would be other functions, but that would be a harder question. I don't know what the Corps' position
the
on that
the
is.
Other but way, it wouldn't be contributing to
it. Wouldn't be contributing to it, exactly. Mm-hmm. It might be neighboring, but whether... That could be considered a significant nexus. Here, it clearly is flowing into it. And I don't know of any case in which there has been prosecution where the water flowed into a wetland and stopped there.
Are wetlands a major source of water in rivers and so on?
Yes, they're also a major source of siltation, reduction, flood control, and water quality preservation. They trap pollutants and filter silt out of the water. All of these as...
So somewhere there might be a figure on the volume of water that, that is emitted by wetlands. Export of water by wetland, something like that.
Yeah, there might. I don't know if there is.
That's not in the record.
That's not in the record here. No, it wasn't contested here at all whether these are wetlands or whether they flow into the tributaries of the Mississippi and Wisconsin rivers. The only issues here were purely legal issues, and the since there was discussion earlier about the Senate report.
But you can see their concern that depending on how extensive these wetlands are and how trivial their actual emission of waters into navigable systems are, you could have quite a federal power grab, right? That's what they're worried about. There don't seem to be any figures on quantities in this record.
There aren't any in this record, no.
But that's something that is taken into consideration whether a permit should be issued. And if it's
exactly.
A de minimis effect, then a permit would probably
exactly.
Be
or sometimes, for example, there may be a wetland that meets the requirements under the Corps manual, but the whole area is so disrupted already, including the wetland at issue, that it isn't considered to really serve the functions that a healthy wetland does, so filling it doesn't really make much of a difference. I've seen permits granted under that kind of a scenario.
But people don't want to be totally at the mercy of the Corps of Engineers, right?
No, they don't. Benevolent as the Corps may be.
that's reassuring.
Gerke argues that Swank constituted a change in the law. I believe this court has addressed whether it constituted a change in the law both in Ruth and in Krillick, where it was considering under Rule 60B whether Swank constituted a change in the law. In the reply brief, Gerke argues that the Corps' interpretation of the Clean Water Act as extending to non-navigable tributaries is not entitled to deference because it constitutes a change in the agency's interpretation of the Act. The Corps changed the regulations in 1975, and consistently since then, the EPA and the Corps have interpreted the Clean Water Act as protecting non-navigable tributaries, which the Supreme Court recognized in U.S. versus Riverside Bayview Homes. Regarding the Commerce Clause, some of the older cases have authority for the proposition that Congress has the authority to regulate non-navigable tributaries in order to protect the traditional navigable waters. Oklahoma versus Atkinson is a Flood Control Act case which describes the broad scope that Congress has under the Commerce Clause to protect the traditional navigable waters. In addition, as to the effects that filling and pollution have on the waters of the United States, U.S. versus Ashland Oil explains, provides reminders that in the decade before that decision, which was in 1974.
The pollution wouldn't affect navigability.
Actually, it does, Your Honor. I was just going to say, in Ashland Oil, they remind us of the Cuyahoga River and a river in Michigan repeatedly catching on fire in the decade before the issuance of that decision. And they also say,
it's actually an old wives' tale. It bears no relation to reality.
Well, I'm sure the Sixth Circuit would be startled to hear that. Under Category 3, Congress may regulate.
It does seem odd, though, if you think that the reason that the federal government controls navigable waterways is to ensure, you know, navigability, and it's an important part of the knitting the country together from a transportation standpoint. And why is pollution relevant to that?
Well, first of all, siltation is one form of pollution, and that clearly has an effect on navigability.
Pollution, but you can if you want. But that's quite different from, you know, water quality, bacteria in the water.
Right. Well, Ashland describes a Supreme Court case in which a barge operator had a lantern on his boat, and it caught on fire because of the fumes in the water on which he was navigating, killed the operator, and blew up his boat. So that's a rather dramatic example.
Yes.
But there are, I'm sure, less dramatic ones, including fish kills, which then, you know, get clogged up in boats and motors, and corrosion, other effects on navigability. But also under Category 3, there are effects on other purposes, the general health and welfare of citizens, which this court recognized in U.S. v. Byrd, and which are also described vividly in Hartzell. The court doesn't have any further questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hazard.
Thank
Mr.
You,
Broderick,
Your Honor.
How much time does he have? Minute? Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors, and I know I have a very short period of time. The court inquired how many wetlands there are in the country. We don't have a total number for that, but on page 25 at the top of our brief, we cite to a couple law review articles that mention big numbers, 170 million acres.
The last place in the world to go to find out how many wetlands there are and what size there are is a law review.
Well, that's true that the law review is...
Technical publications would be more interesting. Do you have any citations to the real sources of data?
No, we don't. And we gave the best sources we had, which was law review articles. We don't argue that Swank was a change in the law in this case. We argue that Swank is fully consistent with Riverside Bayview and with the cases that came before it, that the focus is on navigability and that the Riverside Bayview is really a narrow exception for those wetlands that are inseparably bound up with waters of the United States. As to the point of the longstanding interpretation that the Army Corps has, I'll note again that the original regulations favor our position, and then I'll note the case that I cited in our supplemental authority, Federal Maritime Commission v. C-Train, which says, and I'm running out of time, but I'd like to finish my thought, which says that, quote, an agency may not bootstrap itself into an area in which it has no jurisdiction by repeatedly violating its statutory mandate. If there are no other questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
you.
Broderick and Ms. Hess. Next case for argument, Brand.